Good morning. Well, this is fulfilling, I guess, a request that Martin made some time, well, a few days ago. He said he'd been interested, after discussions of the underlying theory of the structural analysis method for DAEs, when I'd visited him in MSU years ago, and we talked with Jens Hopkins, who was who did some work on putting it such a technique into the COSY system. He'd be interested to see how it's got on since then. So I hope he'll be pleased that it has got on since then. In fact, I think, Ned, can I take this to be the sort of announcement of the release of version 1.0? Sorry? Yes, yeah, okay. So have a bit of introduction about what is makes differential algebraic equation systems different from ordinary differential equation systems. A very quick look at the algorithm, perhaps more oriented at showing what it does to the user interface rather than looking in depth at the algorithm. And then some performance results of various kinds of the code as it exists at present, and then a bit of summary. So DAEs, why are they different? Ordinary differential equation, explicit, meaning it's got y prime on the left-hand side equals some explicit formula. They specify the derivative of a vector of state variables. So basically, you're at a point of space-time, and it tells you a little vector which tells you just in what direction you've got to be going. So they're entirely talking about the evolution of each state variable. A DAE system has got algebraic equations mixed in, which you can't look at one, certainly if you're unfamiliar with them, and say, ooh, well, this says that some of them have the characteristics of evolving variables and other ones don't. But it does sort of have that effect, but very much depending on the type of DAE that you've got. And it's obvious that any quantitative modeling which sets up equations, whether it's in chemistry, you know, chemical kinetics of species reacting, mechanical systems, these being positions and velocities, electrical circuits, or more and more these days a mixture of the two, is going to have some equations in which rates of change are involved, but almost certainly other ones where rates of change are not involved, and it's purely connecting algebraic, purely algebraic equations. And typically, it may be possible to eliminate the purely algebraic equations, but the result may be unnatural. You almost certainly will lose sparsity. It may be very expensive to do. So in many areas, it's more natural to model things as a mixture of differential equations and algebraic equations, and get a DAE, try and solve it as such. And this is the classic example. I think this is actually the title of the paper where she wrote this, DAEs are not ODEs, but I've never actually managed to find it, by Linda Petzold, who's the sort of guru of large-scale DAE solving by traditional methods. So compare those two in problems. On the left, you have a DAE, because the first equation is purely algebraic, It says x naught equals x minus g of t. On the right, the zero has been replaced by some small multiple of the z prime. And provided that epsilon is non-zero, that's an ODE. I hesitate to say it's a perfectly normal ODE because it gets very, very nasty as epsilon gets smaller and smaller. But it is an ODE. It has 3 degrees of freedom. You need to specify 3 initial conditions in order to get a unique solution for an initial value problem. But it's obvious if you look at it a moment that the thing on the left has got no degrees of freedom at all. It's only got one solution, which is necessarily x must equal the given function g of t, and then y must equal g prime of t, and then z must equal g double prime of t. So you can see one of the funny features of DAEs. I call it an apparent reversal of cause and effect. For an ODE, the values of x, y, and z are driving x prime, y prime, and z prime. But on the other hand, in the DAE, the value of x prime is driving y, and the value of y prime is driving z. And as a result, if g of t happens to be rather rough, then the solution y is going to be even rougher, and z is going to be rougher still. And if g happens not to be twice differentiable, then you're in dead trouble. Funny things about DAEs in their very essence as compared with ODEs. Well, DAETS does not try and handle what you do if you have non-differentiable components in the solution, because it is based on Taylor series, so it is assuming that you have arbitrarily smooth functions in the equations and therefore in the solution, though of course you can hit singularities and you have to do something about them. Anyway, it's excellent at high index, which I'll explain in a moment. By the way, that Petzold example I think has got index 3, but you can extend it as far as you like with adding more equations of the same kind and make the index as far as you like. It's good at high accuracy, which by which I mean, and people, not all of you people who know Taylor series will know this very well, that it may be not be competitive for speed at moderate accuracies. It becomes increasingly competitive as you compare with non-Taylor methods as you go to higher accuracies. At the moment, it doesn't handle very large problems. We have to consider, if people come along with large problems, how we should handle this. It's mainly, I think, a question of the linear algebra, but also the handling of the automatic differentiation may also need looking at. And automatic differentiation is handled by the FADBAD++ package of Olaus Downing. We are in communication with Andreas Griewank with the possibility of having it done by Adol C, which he claims would speed it up by a factor of 5 to 10, but that's in its early stages. And then the other main infrastructure, and it's a big one, is IPOPT, which is an optimization package. We're talking, by the way, none of this at the moment is verified computation. We would love it to be. We know in principle how to make DAETS into a verified DAE solver, and I think Ned is going to be thinking with Natalie about this to some extent over the summer, but it's a big project. So anybody who'd like to be on board, come along. Okay. Solves it by Taylor series, as I said. The general form of equations that you write down to define your problem is just arbitrary functions of the independent variable t the state variables xj and any derivatives of them that you wish to include in the equations. So the derivatives don't have to occur on the left hand side, you just write down an expression and that is means that equals zero. So one of the equations could be something like this crazy thing here. I have no reason why this should actually mean anything, but you could write that down with no problems, and it could have second derivatives or third derivatives or something in it as well. So I like to say d by dt is a first class operator on a par with plus, minus, times and divide in the formulation of the system. Okay, the index is something which measures how hard a DAE is to solve in traditional terms, and the probably the oldest version, there's several flavors of it, the differential index roughly means how many times do you have to differentiate one or more of the equations that make up the system in order to get a mishmash of equations which you can then algebraically manipulate to eliminate things, use the implicit function theorem as required, and at least in principle turn it into an ODE. So for traditional methods, 3 and above is considered hard. The standard codes like Linda Petzold, Dassel handle index 1 and just as if it was ODEs. Index 2 with a little bit of help, more or less as if they were ODEs. Is that right, Ken? Okay. Okay. Our code is based on my structural analysis idea, which makes it in principle unaffected by the index, and we've solved these problems up to index 47, as I shall illustrate. They don't really mean anything physical, but it seems to handle them with no problems. Okay, quick numerical method summary. So you start with the code which define the DAE, which is set up as a C++ function, except it uses templated types because the code is actually interpreted at compile time in, I think it's 4 different ways currently, so as to do various kinds of symbolic analysis as well as the numerical side. So just looking at the numerical, using the AD package, you evaluate, you go in stages, and at each stage you evaluate suitable derivatives of these functions fi, different r's in one stage, as I'll show, and then you equate these to zero in batches. So you do one batch to get one batch of Taylor coefficients, then you differentiate a bit more and you get another batch of differentiated Fs, and you evaluate those, equate those to zero and get another batch of Taylor coefficients, etc. So you do that up to whatever order of Taylor you've decided, sum the series, step to the next point, and then you've got to project the approximate solution you've got onto the constraint, the algebraic constraints, which are also part of the FIs and some derivatives of them, in order to get a consistent point. Consistent simply means satisfying any algebraic constraints. And then you repeat in the usual way for a step-by-step initial value solver. Okay, and before you do this, you do the crucial thing, which is the structural analysis, where you pre-process using the magic of C++ templated types to do this symbolic thing, basically scanning through the code list to set up various matrices and stuff. And out of this, you get a thing called a linear assignment problem, which is actually a kind of linear programming problem. And the solution of the dual of that is these 2n offsets, which one for each of the state variables xr, xj, and one for each of the functions fi, and that's what prescribes the batches in the overall process of solving the Taylor coefficients. And this is basically what George Corliss and I worked out the principles of in 1996, and it's taken this far to get it to a working code. Okay, and they imply the initial values data, all right, for ODE, you just give y1, well, say x, y prime equals f of t and y. You give y1 to yn, that's the initial values, and that's pretty straightforward. For DAEs solved by this method, it's a irregular array, I call it, initial data. So the notorious simple pendulum still seems to be the best example for illustrating what's going on. This is a simple pendulum hanging from a fixed point of length L with its rigid rod, and x, y is the coordinates of the pendulum bob, with x horizontal, y sticking downwards. X of t and y of t therefore describe the actual motion. Lambda is a Lagrange multiplier which has simple physical interpretation. It's a constant multiple of the tension or compression in the rod. It turns out that the offsets are what given by that thing there. You have to, as a user, understand what these mean in broad terms to understand how you set up initial values for this code. So the variables having offsets 2, 2, and 0 tell you that the initial values you've got to provide, you have to provide the variable and its derivatives up to but not including the value of the offset. So x, you provide x, x prime, but not x double prime, and so on. Lambda, there's a zero there, you don't have to provide anything at all, which is counterintuitive, perhaps. Except, as part of the symbolic analysis pre-processing, the code can tell whether the problem is linear or not in the leading derivatives. That means x double prime, y lambda. If it is, that's all you have to do. If it's not linear, then in order to get local of your solution, you have to provide an extra set of derivatives here, x double prime, y double prime, and lambda. So this is what I mean by you provide an irregular array. So it's either that shape or this shape, depending on whether the problem has been diagnosed as quasi-linear or not quasi-linear, which is what I mean by what's the term we use for linear in the leading derivatives. And the offsets also tell you what are the algebraic constraints which have to be projected upon at each step. In the linear case, it's h and h prime. That comes again from the offsets up to but not including the derivative of the offset derivative, right? So f and g don't provide any constraints, and h provides two of them. So this obviously says the rod has got to stay at length exactly L, and the second one is what Tennyson more or less said. Much of that. Finding the consistent point can be very difficult for a highly nonlinear problem, and we give it, we formulate it as a minimization problem and give it to the IPOPT, which is a gesture we couldn't dream of doing, and it just seems to do it very well and robustly. Ned, I don't think we've ever really found problems in finding consistent points. IPOP does a good job for us. Okay, so that's so much for the algorithmic aspects and the providing initial values and so on of the user interface. Now let's have some numerical results. See how accurate it is compared with Dassel and Radow on standard problems. A high index problem, looking at how efficient it is compared with other codes on another standard problem, and looking at it on a continuation problem. Okay, so do some accuracy versus tolerance plot. And this is from the standard test set for initial value problem solvers, which used to be hosted in Amsterdam, but is now hosted in Italy. And looking at the transistor amplifier problem, which is a size n equals 8, and we compare it with Radow and Dassel. And then also, the scheme is that it gives a reference solution in the documentation, which was computed on a Cray in double precision or something, with a believed very highly accurate method. On the other hand, Ned also computed it with DATS with the most accurate tolerance that it would handle, and the DATS curve takes that as the reference solution and suggests very strongly that actually that our reference solution is more accurate than the reference solution. And the significant correct digits is by a fairly obvious meaning. Component-wise relative error, not norm-wise relative error, is pretty strict. and then take minus log 10 of that to count it as number of digits. The blue curve is Dassel, which handles things up to around tolerance 10 to the minus 10, actually produces about 9 digits of accuracy there. Radow gets another couple of digits. DAETS is happily going beyond that, and levels off compared to the reference solution on the red curve at 10 to the minus 12 and a bit. But it looks very strongly from the black dotted line that it actually keeps going, getting more accurate as you go up towards 10 to the minus 14. Let's see. So that's what it, more or less I've said that. The multipendular class of high index problems, let me just draw a little picture. You think of a whole lot of pendulums in a row, this, the one on the left, is undriven, but there's some little coupling, which means that the tension in the rod there, which is the value of lambda essentially, has some slight effect on the length of the next pendulum, which you could imagine having some physical reality if you put a little servo mechanism in between them. It wouldn't have to be very sophisticated if the next one was very much lighter than the rest. And that carries on all the way. So each one is influencing the one next to it. So that's just for two pendula, and carry on in the same way for any number. One pendulum has got 3 8 variables, size 3. P pendulum obviously have 3 P variables, and it turns out the index is 2 P plus 1. It's pretty obvious that this is exactly the sort of thing you'd expect to give chaotic behavior, and so it appears. And Ned has output P equals 23. I don't know why you stopped there. Any particular reason, Ned? Giving index 47. And here's just a sample. I think the idea here was that you did two multipendula in parallel. I think we were solving, you know, two at the same time, but not coupled with each other, just to make it easier to do the plots. And tolerance 10 to the minus 9, and I think the initial conditions of the second set were displaced by a random amount of about 10 to the minus 9 from the ones of the first one. So a slight difference in initial conditions, and you see the two things are very, very similar until you get to a certain point, and then there's a very rapid deviation until finally the very quickly they're not correlated with each other at all, apparently, which is what you would expect from chaotic behavior. And if you then look, I think this is the norm of the difference between the two solutions as a function of time on a log scale. It's broadly speaking exponentially diverging, which again is what you would expect from chaotic behavior. Efficiency, we have to admit that the code doesn't do particularly well on efficiency compared with the established ones at moderate accuracies. And looking at four problems here from the test set, car axis, index 3, a couple of index 1 DAEs, and high res, which is a stiff but not massively stiff ODE. High up the diagram is bad, meaning slow. So you can see here that Dassault can't handle the car axis because the index is too high. So it's just compared with Radau. Radau is obviously massively faster at moderate accuracies, but all the DATS curves are fairly flat, which means the work only increases very slowly and modestly as the tolerance is screwed down. So at high accuracies we can get very high accurate ones, whereas Radau obviously can't get more than about 5 digits no matter what you do with it. Dassault on this next one, jumping all over the place with its CPU times and accuracy, can't get more than about 8 digits. Radau is getting about 10 digits. We go up to 11 digits. We get 14 digits with no problem. Chemical AXO is similar. The funny thing about this high-res one is that our red curve, it looks flat. It does have a look of being slightly decreasing, and indeed it is. So why is it that screwing down the if you ask for more accuracy, you use less CPU time? We haven't quite worked this out. We have an idea, but that's certainly an interesting feature. I think I've said all of that. Right, continuation problems. There's no need for derivatives actually to be present in the formulation of the problem, so it is perfectly capable of solving purely algebraic continuation problems, where here lambda is the independent variable. So you're basically seeking how the solution of an algebraic equation depends on a parameter. This is a well-known way of solving very difficult algebraic problems. Start with lambda equals naught being an easy problem, and then lambda moves up to lambda equals 1, where it's the problem you're trying to solve. Anyway, one of the things which happens almost always with serious continuation problems, right? You've got a path of solutions in X lambda space. So there's X, which is in n-dimensional space. And it typically happens that dx by d lambda becomes infinite at certain places, which is a turning point. But if you look at it in x lambda space together, there's nothing special about that. It just happens to be a place where the tangent of this nice smooth curve happens to be, well, orthogonal to the lambda axis. You solve, you cure this as a numerical problem by going typically to arc length continuation, which involves defining a new independent variable called arc length, which is defined by this, or you can put weight factors in if you think the Euclidean measure is not quite what you want. Anyway, that turns it into an index 1 DAE of size 1 bigger than you started with. And the trouble with continuation problems, typically, almost always, you are subject to in difficult cases, you have paths which look as if they cross, but they aren't actually crossing. Right, the generic behavior is you have a very close approach like that. And if you just consider something like x squared minus y squared equals epsilon, where epsilon is small, you can see why that is a very common sort of situation. So the difficulty is that this looks nice and straight, except there's a sharp bend coming up. And many methods will miss that sharp bend, but one of the things about Taylor methods is if you use a high enough order, the Taylor coefficients get big quite a long way away, and it notices that bend, and it'll shorten the step size. So that proved to be very much the case if you did it right. And here's... the Lane-Watson problem. It's a sort of made-up problem, but it's very, very nasty. So you're sort of looking for a fixed point of this weird function here. I won't say more about it at the moment, unless people ask. Here is, even for n equals 10, which is considered difficult, here's a path of lambda this way. And you can see loads of turning points present where there's that path becomes a vertical tangent. That's just a couple of two out of the 10 state variable parameters. It turned out that you needed to put a maximum on the step size, which the code allows you to do to make that happen, to make it not have tracking failure. I think I'll skip the next bit on the structural analysis and summary here. We've got a robust code now based on this structural analysis theory, and it's very good for high index, it's very good for high accuracy. We have submitted a paper on the code to a special issue of the Journal of Numerical Analysis, Industrial and Applied Mathematics, edited by Larry Champagne this spring. User guide final touches. Well, I think we've actually done that. I still keep finding places where it should have been worded better, but I have to stop sometime. These are the rules here. There's a free demo version available, which will solve problems up to n equals 8 variables, which you get from the website Ned is just putting up. And for the commercial version, you go to the Canadian Flintbox site, and we have single user academic 199, multi user academic 399, commercial 599. And obviously it is for programming, so it comprises a binary library and the header files. So there we are. Thanks to Ned as the main software architect of it, and we certainly have plans to keep him busy, and I'll stop there. But if you want to see how one codes up the simple pendulum, that's just the function bit of it, and that is the complete main, the simple complete main program that follows. So it's not terribly onerous to write a simple program using DAETS. Okay.
Thank you very much. So, what questions do we have?
On your graph going down.
Yes.
When you see, you do have typically in analytic functions, at least the ones I've played with, when you start increasing the accuracy, a lot of coefficients get very small. And so you probably have a cutoff which throws them to zero and doesn't consider them anymore in the code.
We don't actually have a cutoff, not in the way that I believe Martin has a threshold and chucks coefficients into the error term. So I think we have to look elsewhere for the reason for it. Ned, have you got a convincing explanation at the moment?
The code that you have for checking whether the equations are nonlinear and leaving your instance.
Yeah.
Does it detect, for example, if the leaving your instance has coefficient, the sine square, the cosquare, or something?
No. It is simple mind isn't totally naive. If I just had x1 squared plus x1 minus x1 squared, it would not notice that they cancelled. Mm-hmm. It's not intended to do manipulation.
Couldn't you just evaluate this with a multivariate automatic differentiation thing, and then, if the derivatives say R0 up to order 13 or so, declare victory.
Well, consider that. Yes.
I mean, good enough for engineers, probably. To
yes, but what is zero? You know, you have to consider what's happening when round off is stopping things being exactly zero. After all, sine squared plus cos squared might not come out as exactly one, might it?
Actually, I also your paper there said differential algebraic solver 3. So I take it there's also 2 and 1.
Oh, those two earlier papers, yes. One on computing Taylor coefficients and one on computing the system Jacobian, which is a very key feature of the method.
Mm. Any more questions? Well, if not, then let's thank you. And we each have some goodies at least to come there at 10:30. I'm not sure if they're here already. But then let's start again at 10:30.
So how can your white screen Mac do this? So basically, it looks full screen on your white screen Mac, but then it compresses it to regular format, apparently.
Yes.
I always wondered about it.
Yeah, you mean it's a bit wider here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's clever. Yeah. I don't know how it does it. Does it? Yes.
Okay.
Before you pack up, might I get the presentation?
Yeah, sure.
One is to see you, one is to see you.
Yeah. Can you do me a favor when you're done, plug the power into this one?
Sure thing, yes. So you're the official archivist for this, are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Collect them all and get them on the website.
Yes.
I don't have to know it's the Thursday, but once the problem is if there's a ton of schedule, there's no talk after that. First, I'm there now, I talk to you, because 10:30 is finished. So then I check out at noon, go back, get the
bag. Yep.
And for the offset, they are determined by code, right? When you just input the system, it can be determined by your code. Like 220.
Yeah, just a moment. Here we are.
There is something in the morning and it's heard in the morning.
Yeah, thank you very much. Sorry. Yes.
Oh,
yes, you were saying.
I said the offset, like it's the 22 or something,
yes.
They are determined by the code.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
When we just input the system, the code will come out and then values. And
yes.
Then for the initial values, like x prime, or how can you determine by the, how can you determine the
initial you mean, values? How do you determine which initial values?
Yes.
Well, I described how the offsets tell you what you have to provide, but the actual numerical values, well, that's up to you.
Yeah, how many, what kind
yes.
of
how many is determined for you by the code. Yes.
For the initial value, how can you determine for the power bar? For the initial value, initial values, how can you determine that? You know how many you need to
yes.
determine, right?
Well, it has, you know, you can determine various things. I mean, you can give it various things because, like the pendulum, you have to give it the initial position.